AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Dow Automotive Systems. Learn how we can help you arrive at cost-effective and innovative solutions to your toughest industry challenges at DowAutomotive.com.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, episode 30 for Thursday, October 29th, 2009, Up From Down Under. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLineDetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours Greenwich Mean Time. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine After Hours in the iTunes Music Store. Welcome to another episode, although I keep telling myself I should not say that. Just welcome to AutoLine After Hours. And joining us here, as always, in the studio, the auto extremist himself, Peter DeLorenzo. Peter, great being back here with you.
John, welcome back. We missed you.
Yeah, well, believe me, I'm glad to be back, but I was glad to be gone, too.
Long stretch in the desert, but you're back.
Yeah. So what you got going on your site this week? What have you been ranting about?
Went off on the UAW. I do that every once in a while.
Oh, with the problems with Ford.
Yeah, it's just, to me, it's just totally unacceptable.
It's, well, the leadership hasn't been out there leading on this one, I don't think.
Well, there's a split in that leadership. This Bob King guy is the guy to watch. I think he is, he wants Gettelfinger's job.
Oh, I think he's got Gettelfinger's
job. Yeah, and he's using this to make his, you know, he's going to hold himself up to the working man as I've got your backs. In the meantime, he looks like a horse's ass.
Wow. Sounds like a good column.
He's a hardcore union guy. I mean, not that Gettelfinger isn't, but
yeah, but
what
just,
I've heard about King is he's...
Just what they don't need going forward, let's put it that way.
Yeah, and of course, the voice of you listening on the podcast that just came in is David Welch from Business Week. Great having you back here, or
be
me
good.
Being back here with you.
That's right. Glad to be here as always.
And our special guest today is Mark Royce, who runs all global product engineering for General Motors. Great having you here, Mark.
Thanks, John. This is kind of a new experience for me coming back from Australia here for a couple of years. And this is a neat program and a neat format, so I appreciate you having me here.
Yeah, and boy, you've seen all kinds of turmoil. You got out of Dodge at a good time. I mean, you were down half a world away watching the fiasco that we've gone here, the disaster that we've gone here. It must have been kind of strange being out of the country, being away from, you know, the North American headquarters and all, watching what was going on here.
Yeah, it was almost surreal because my assignment there, began February of 2008. And so, you know, you're watching it, you know, a little bit, and then you're reading about it, and you try and get everything you get your hands on, you know, news-wise, that's not filtered through the international media into a different country. So you can kind of see if you can get the truth, you know, and because I'm not here every day down there, you know, being down there. But, yeah, it was very sad for me as an American in Australia, seeing what's happening there. And so it was tough. It was very tough. Also, running a subsidiary down there, you know, you're seeing the parent company go through this, and then the parent company, just so you know, the business model we run in GM on a global basis is the parent company really provides the money to invest, and then, you know, you invest, you make product, and then you pay that dividend back to the parent company, and then you reinvest, and you keep running it, right? Well, when you go through something like that, it's very tough because the parent company gets circled off from it. And so, you know, we then go into the bankruptcy piece of this in the December timeframe, and, you know, the funds, everything that we use to operate just to turn on our casting plant or the lights in Australia, you don't have that anymore. And so you start selling cars. You got to sell cars to feed your people and turn on the lights. And that's what we did. And you know, the backstop piece of this on a liquidity basis, the government down there is a government that truly cares about the industry, about the companies, and, you know, the the 70,000 or so people that we got, you know, making things down there. So it was really a positive experience from that standpoint, because they want to put policy in place that means that we co-invest with the government into new product, and the product has to meet certain guidelines for fuel economy and greenhouse gases. And, you know, we put a $6.3 billion fund in place there with the government to co-invest as an industry on new products. And it wasn't a loan. It wasn't a grant. It was money that they want to reinvest and redo the auto industry there. So, you know, I was president at the time of the industry down there. And so we led that policy and co-investment strategy with Ford and Toyota and my colleagues there, and then the Prime Minister of Australia. So it was really just an exciting time, really, really rewarding, very tough, because no one writes the playbook for this, especially as an engineer down there. But, you know, I feel very proud of what the whole team did there for the people who work for the company and in the industry, and, you know, what the future is.
It's a cool operation. I mean, it's a totally vertically integrated operation, right? It's got its own design studio, own engineering, do a lot of engineering, not just for Holden, but for the rest of General Motors as well.
Yep.
Huge manufacturing capabilities down there. It's a full-blown test track, the whole nine yards. I mean, it's really kind of like car companies were in the old days, but on a much smaller scale.
That's a great point, because, you know, you go into that assembly plant down there, and the assembly plant is in a place called South Australia, which is a state. And then you have a plant in a city called Elizabeth. And you look at that plant, and you walk in there, and the plant's been there for many, many years, obviously, more than 60. 60 is the company, but the plant was there before as a coach builder. And the plant was opened by Queen Elizabeth.
No kidding.
Yeah, and so you see the pictures of her, you know, riding up in a motorcade and you know, in the front of the plant, and here you are, you walk into work, and that's where you work. So it's quite a place. We had two engine plants there, a V6 and an old Family One cast iron plant there that was non-emission compliant, so we had to close it. But we took as many people as we could out of that, and then reinvested in direct injection for the V6 that's made there. So, you know, it makes
That engine shipped out of Australia too, right?
Yeah, and many variants. Yeah, many variants. It goes into the SRX in North America. We ship it into North America as well, and then there's a couple other places in Asia Pacific we bring it into as well. So,
how tough is it to make money on cars built in Australia and exported to the U.S.?
Well, you know, obviously everything's dependent on FX. You know, you're probably as a business writer much more fluid in this than I have. Except I did live this for 18 months down there on FX basis, and when the you know, it's a dual-edged sword, because you're bringing parts in. Some parts from different places in the world, but you're exporting a whole car.
Right.
And so, you know, there's value coming in, but there's value going out. And so when the dollar gets to be almost parity with the Australian dollar, which it was when I came down there in February of 2008, you can make a lot of money on that. Okay. So it's FX dependent, but, you know, I'm not sure FX.
FX means exchange rate?
Sorry, exchange rate, yeah. But I don't think you should run the business on an exchange rate basis, because you know, I'm not smart enough, and I don't know a whole lot of people that are, that can really forecast where that is. But I think in the long term, if you run the business right around 70 cents there in Australia, you're probably making most of the right decisions on an import and export basis. And you'll see some places where you go up and down on it. But you can make money on it for sure, and you can.
Yeah. It gets to one of the big questions people in the States always have, because they go online and they see these cool Holden cars and they're rear-wheel drive, so they have cool design proportions and they're performance driving cars. And, well, just bring them here. Why can't GM just bring them here? You know, they don't know what they're doing. That's why they don't bring them here. I mean, these are the comments on our website all the time.
I read all the comments and all the internet stuff, and you know, and I'm glad people like the cars, and I'm glad that they want us to export something like that in here. But, you know, the core business, you know, if you look at the way we set up a footprint like Holden, where we got two engine plant and a final assembly plant, we got to make money where we're designing and making that stuff, and that's in Australia. And so we got to make that money first. And if we can export a car that makes sense into a market like North America, then, you know, we should do that. And we did. And, you know, we can get into all the brand stuff and all that stuff about Pontiac. But at the end of the day, these cars, these are great cars globally, because they're great cars. And so, there's always an export opportunity there, I think. You know, I really do.
Are you talking about the V6? Which V6 are you talking about? The optional turbo motor in the SRX?
Well, there's a turbo motor. Right. That's the one that's going into the SRX.
Right.
But we make the high feature V6 down there.
Okay.
Okay, so we got a 3-liter SIDI. We got a 3.6. We've got all kinds of variants, and that's probably the most flexible plant we have on a V6 basis in the company. So it's a pretty cool place. And again, we co-invested, some of that with the government a few years ago, and as did Ford and Toyota. And so they're very interested in getting technology and then the brain that creates the technology on a localized basis and taking advantage of the universities there. It's a very collaborative environment. It's very neat. Yeah.
This must have been a great assignment for you. I mean, career up to this point has been right in the product itself, right? I mean, you were heavily involved with the V series, the Solstice, the Sky. Yep. I can't even think of all the different products that you were involved with. This has got to be a totally different part of your career.
It was an opportunity of a lifetime, and that's all I can say because, the people there and the culture. You know, I have three kids. I have a 5-year-old girl and a 13-year-old son and a 15-year-old girl, and those are the ages when, especially with my oldest girl, where, you wonder if everybody's going to be okay going that far away in high school and all that. But, when you get there, the people are so positive and so nice, and it's so multinational. And, we lived outside of Melbourne there, where Holden and the plants were. And that city is a real city. I mean, it is just fantastic. Fantastic. So we loved it. It was hard. It was hard to leave it because we just went through all that. We got everybody right in terms of capacity and products and loaded with product. That was real fun. Yeah, really nice.
How involved were you with the G8? I mean, obviously it was being built while you were down there. Had you worked on that car or that program at all before being assigned to Holden?
I did. I had before that job, I had global engineering staffs around the world doing safety integration, virtual engineering, for a better word for it, CAE type stuff. All of our product, core product development stuff. And so we did things like, homologating some of the suppression airbags for the G8 for the United States market because it wasn't needed in Australia at that time. So, we'd done a lot of sled testing, a lot of airbag testing. For the G8, before I went down there. So, yeah, it was fun.
Because that car is amazing. It's hit, like, damn near cult status in this market.
Yeah,
and maybe that's, guaranteed it. The fact that, Pontiac was killed, it's going to be an icon car forever now.
Well, I hope so. Yeah, it'd be good.
Well, when Pontiac was going away and then the G8 was going away as well, there was a lot of chatter on the websites, but just, in the auto world, bring this thing back as a Chevrolet and do it as fast as you can. Some said it was rebadging, but by and large, the people of the car said, hey, bring it back. You got a hit here. Why wouldn't you do that? Can you kind of walk us through that a little bit and tell us why you guys didn't just, sort of have this, crack team to as quickly as possible get that car under one of the existing brands and sell it again? I mean, you guys had a bona fide hit here with this thing.
Well, we did, and I can tell you that we... we had a lot of discussion around that, and I did very late at night. I think Fritz said it really well that, we're going into bankruptcy here. Don't forget the timing of this, okay? We're going into bankruptcy. We're saying we're not going to have Pontiac anymore. We're doing all that stuff, and we're using taxpayers' money, okay, on a loan basis right now for the company. And so, I think I'm a taxpayer too, So I'm an owner in GM, too. And, you look at this and you say, okay, we're going to do this for a little bit while we go through bankruptcy and get the place right from a balance sheet and spending standpoint. And so the integrity around badge engineering, pure badge engineering, none of us felt very good about that. And so if there's an opportunity to do something else, maybe a little later, You know, like you say, people will remember what this car is and what this architecture is. And if there's an opportunity to do some things to the car to make the car even better, maybe, or do it in a different way, then, you know, sticking Chevrolet badges on it right now and doing it, you know, we got to be really, we really got to think about that, you know. And don't forget the Saturn piece that was going on at the time, too. So we're trying to do everything we can with integrity in the company on a product basis. So, you know, that was the discussion.
So the police are going to get the benefit of it now.
How long do the cops keep them? Don't they only keep them for 2 or 3 years before they dump them in the used market?
Well, I think the police, this is a good car, so I think the police can keep it for a long time. Yeah. And do.
How far away is that from actually getting in the police hands?
Well, we don't know, because this isn't something that you say, well, we're just going to go do, and then we're going to, here's the demand, and we're going to put it in a dealership. So, you know, we got to make sure the police actually understand what we're doing to the car for them and make their car for them. I mean, that's what we're doing. We're making the police car for the police. And so, you know, when the police start ordering it and they like it, then we'll make it, and we'll make as many as they want. And so it's a little bit different business. This is, you know, it's not our typical, here's how we're going to position the car, here's how we're going to advertise it. There really isn't any advertising or positioning on it other than, you know, it's a great-looking car, it's got great performance.
It's pure fleet. Yeah. Well, what if Jay Leno calls up and says, look, I'll pay you double, just give me one of them.
hey, look, we'll probably sell cars to Jay Leno, police cars, if he wants one, you know. But we'll probably have to do something special with, you know, where you use it and stuff, but... So, you know, and I think there's, you know, I think there's a real good thing that'll happen with these police cars, too, is that people will like seeing the car. And so it never hurts to build a little bit of interest, you know, around making a decision on a product decision. So we'll see how people really like the car with a Chevrolet badge on it and see how that goes.
Tell us a little bit about what you're doing right now, because GM has changed a lot since. I don't need to tell you that, obviously.
18 months, it's a different company, which is good.
Right. So is this a brand new position, you know, heading up all global product engineering as opposed to just engineering or product development? Explain to us, you know, what the change has been and what you're doing there.
Well, just on a real basic level, we probably have taken out half of the structure of management in product development. So that's a big change, and I think you probably all saw that. So, you know, Terry Wachowski, who runs our program management and vehicle chief organization, runs our programs. And if you just think of a very simple chart that you know, we're you know, vehicle engineering, global vehicle engineering, which is what I run, all of our centers around the world and our capability and our new technology feeds those programs. And then Terry's group runs those programs. So it's pretty simple. And so, you know, I love it. You know, it's very different than what we did before. I don't want to try and explain what we did before, because we're not doing that anymore. But what we are doing is quite different, and it's driving, I think, a lot of different cultural things just by the organizational structure, which is very simple. And, you know, I sit on Tom Stevens' staff, and he's got design, he's got myself, he's got Terry, he's got John Lochner, who runs planning. And, you know, he's got a few other folks there, too. And so we run the product development factory here. So it's pretty...
How much does Bob Lutz still control this thing or get involved? I mean, he has design, but he's also mostly marketing, and at least that's his title. I still think he's greatly involved with product. So how does that work? Because Tom Stevens reports to Fritz, and he's the head of product development, so... The org chart says it ought to flow up through Tom, but this is Bob Lutz we're talking about.
you know, we're thrilled that he's still involved because at the end of the day, you know, you can PowerPoint this and organize it to death, okay? But if you got a few guys in a room that know how to do it and
what the hell they're doing,
you know, it gets pretty simple, and it gets pretty real, and it gets pretty frank. And you know, we talk about a lot of these things very openly, and we get in debates, and Bob helps us do that. So he's got a role that I'm not sure anybody's going to org chart or title or to death, but, you know, he's there. And you know, Tom Stevens is – I've never worked for Tom before, but Tom and him have a great relationship, which is makes it painless for everybody else that has to execute, and it's pretty good, pretty seamless. So it's a different way of talking about it probably than what GM has talked about it before. Where you know, we get into the, you know, who exactly does what, you know, and if you do this, then you're the guy who we're gonna, you know, all that, you know, it's pretty collaborative, very collaborative, and very different, and it feels pretty good.
It's got to be especially different having axed four different brands. Mm-hmm. It's got to make things a lot more clear as to what you've got to do. But this whole question mark about going forward with Opel has got to sort of mess it up again.
Well, it does a little bit, but I got to tell you, we have worked very hard over the last probably 8 years on a very integrated relationship with product development in Opel. And so the global engineering and product development footprint that we have, you know, I got a guy who is a good friend, but also a just one of the best engineers I've ever met, running Opel as a managing director and head of engineering. And then I got a guy who's in America that ran engineering in Opel that now runs integration safety and virtual analysis as an international person here. So this isn't Opel sitting over there alone doing Opel products and then we decide what we're going to export. That organization is obviously one of the very most capable in the world from a product development engineering standpoint. And so that is very integrated into what we do globally. So that won't change with the relationship that we see that we're forming with what is going to be the new entity there. So those people are all very integrated and highly skilled and have great relationships with everybody around the globe in product development. So
it's interesting, you're going to get 100% of the volume, sales volume benefit and engineering benefit, but only 35% of the losses.
Well, I guess, again, David, you're probably more skilled at this than I am on a cut-to-the-chase business standpoint, but I don't know that. But what I do know is we're trying to really make sure that cars that we have in the global product development system will happen and benefit, you know, everybody that's involved with it. I mean, that's the way it's being structured, so... you know, we're not afraid of it by any stretch because, you know, we've been operating seamlessly for, again, about 8 years. We're embracing it as something that we're going to do, and we're going to make it work really well.
So let's talk about...
Is it hard? Yeah. I mean, to your question, yeah, it's hard.
Yeah. Let's talk about some fun things. Have you,
yeah.
been, to Tom,
okay.
have you been to Tom Stevens' pole barn yet?
I haven't.
Okay.
I haven't.
Were all his cars there?
Yeah, we've been pretty flat out here. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I know I've been to car shows and seen before I worked for him what he brings to it, which is pretty cool stuff. I saw, I haven't seen an Elante with an R-Star engine for a while, and that was really cool.
He has 18 or 19 cars, right?
I think it's more than that.
Yeah, I think
he's got a buddy, and the two of them own a bunch of cars together.
Yeah, yeah.
He's got some, it's either a Caprice or something with some monster motor in it that...
Like, where do you see the future of performance going? I mean, everybody's got to march to CAFE. We're all worried about oil prices exploding again.
Sure.
One thing that we've talked about is, you know, Peter keeps driving home the point, electric cars are going to be a small niche for many years to come. But one thing I do like about electrics, instant torque. I mean, yeah. I think we could do some cool performance stuff with that. But where do you see it all going?
I know we can. We went on a went on a ride here with the guys. Every Friday, by the way, we do this thing out at Milford where we take it out into Ann Arbor, and I'm not telling you where it happens, but we go out on a pretty neat area there, and we take our competitors and then we take various cars in development, and we have a ride with myself and then some of the folks that are doing engine and transmission calibration, ride tuning, steering, the integration of the car. We take it out there, and we get into where we need to be from a competitive standpoint to beat where we think the competition is going to be, and we use their car as the benchmark that we're going to beat, and we go out there and talk about how we're going to beat it. We had a volt ride out there last Friday, a 65 percenter of calibration, which is a amount of code and development that we have for the powertrain.
Meaning that once it gets to 100%, it's production ready?
That's right. Okay. And so we're right in we have these different gates without going through our whole product development.
Yeah, that's okay. 65%, I think we caught on to that.
Yeah, all right. Well, you can think about what that really means. But anyway, we took the car out there, and you know, the car, you kind of forget what you're driving, which is kind of the highest compliment that I could give the guys. I said, you know, we go out here and you forget you're in a science experiment, which it is, from a battery standpoint, from a thermal standpoint, from an HVAC and cooling standpoint, it just goes on and on, rolling resistance of the tires, and you get in the car and you're like, wow, you know, we got a couple of modes of this car, okay? And
what do you mean a couple of modes?
A couple of modes on how it works, okay? And
you mean different performance settings, as it were?
Remember the Converge, John?
Yeah, just different ways we could do an e-ride.
Oh, thank you for that tip, Peter.
Well, just different ways we operate an e-rev.
Okay. Yeah.
And so you know, you're driving it and you step into it. I mean, you really step into it, and it is a unintuitive amount of torque with no shifts. You know, I think then you think about what you're actually driving and the way it's operating, and it's very cool. And so is there some performance things we can do with this? Absolutely. Is that what we need to focus on? Probably not right now. But we know the bandwidth. And, you know, the bandwidth, fun cars are, you know, fun cars are always going to be fun cars. And I hate getting into how many are going to be electric. I don't know. I don't think anybody exactly knows.
Yeah, they're always going to be fun
cars. I mean, you know, there's going to be different cars, which is why the industry is great, right?
Mm-hmm.
And why it's just so challenging and fun. But, you know, I do know that, you know, people still like to drive fun cars, and it doesn't matter what the power mode is. Fun cars are always going to be an advantage. So
generally, you can say performance for GM going forward is smaller displacement. I mean, talking about ICE, smaller displacement, direct injection, probably boosted.
Yeah, I mean, you're right on. And I'm not sure it's any one of those, and it shouldn't be.
No, I'm just saying generally.
Yeah, generally speaking, but
smaller, lighter, but still the power to weight ratio.
I think so. I think it, you know, if you look at the whole car and then you look at powertrains and the whole car, you're right on, because the boosted piece of this, we're going to figure out things that we didn't know before, like hyper struts, okay, and spindle lengths to get power to the front of the car.
Wait, explain that. What do you mean?
Well, if you...
Basically.
Basically, you know, we're talking about things that, you know, on a transverse front drive car, generally speaking on a smaller vehicle, you know, you talk about how do you get air into the engine, how do you convert that into power, and then how do you get the power to the ground. Very challenging in a small motor compartment with, you know, a weight-biased front end with a very limited package for differentials and powertrains. So those are very creative solutions that we haven't quite seen all yet. And so what this is all doing is pushing us to think way beyond what we used to be able to do as an industry. And for that, for me, is a tremendous set of doors that have opened.
So if I understand it, you're talking about being able to take power and put it to the wheels, to the ground, more efficiently.
Yes.
As you say, you know, front drive.
Yeah, in a very constrained area.
Bias.
Yeah, very constrained area. And by the way, the stylists, you know, and the designers that we work hand in hand with want dramatic proportions, and it is very challenging from a thermal standpoint, you know, to not cook everything or to get, you know, the air charge into the engine, all that stuff. So it's actually one of the parts of my job that I love.
Go back. What were those terms you used? Something spindle and what was the other thing?
Yeah, well, there's spindle lengths and there's geometry there that if you blow that or if you don't get it right, mm-hmm. you're going to torque steer the car or you're going to spin the wheels, blah, all that stuff, okay? And you saw some of the hyper strut. We call it a hyper strut, but it's a very nice package on a corner of a car, on a front-wheel drive car, that gets you out of some of this stuff. And you've seen it on some of the small high-performance cars that we've done that were very successful on the track recently. So, and you'll see that kind of thinking and innovation as we bring out things off of Epsilon, for instance.
You're talking about basically getting better performance out of front-drive cars.
Well, that is the
better
arena.
Handling.
That's one arena. But then you look at something like what we're doing at Holden, where you get... you know, an incredible, you actually get more power and better fuel economy out of a 3-liter or a 3.6 than what you got out of the regular engine with a technology change that's in the actual head and the power dome of the cylinder. And so you got both out of that. You know, that's a tremendous bang, okay? So the innovation that's going on in either front-wheel drive or rear-wheel drive and our powertrains and the mass of our vehicles, okay? I read your blogs, and they say, well, GM still doesn't get it. They're making too heavy cars. These guys are right, okay? We did. And so what are we going to do now? We're going to do some pretty neat things. So
like we've said, the internal combustion engine has a long way to go in terms of efficiency. And let's talk about the C7, Mark.
The C7.
So,
I don't know anything about that.
Yeah,
I'll bet you don't. Yeah, right,
let's
talk
about our newest Corvette engine. We
will talk about the Grand Sport because there's a major error on that car that I'm going to point out. But so the
C7. This was in the one for a week, so.
It's a cool car.
It's a cool car.
So the C7, you know, it's going to be a smaller footprint, lighter.
Well, you showed some pretty neat concept photos on your site.
Ed Welburn, I mean, we know that the Stingray concept, there's going to, it's, that's
good.
The flavor.
It's it's all good.
Split window. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I'm guessing it's a 3/4 to 7/8 size of the current car. It has to be, and lighter. And you're probably considering, for the first time, a smaller engine, a base car, and then a higher typical V8.
Well, you're outlining an approach for Corvette. There it is. Isn't that great?
He's taking the Sergeant Schultz defense. I know nothing.
No. I won't say I know nothing because the team has worked over the last year or so as we went through bankruptcy. Isn't that great?
It's beautiful. I'm stunned by that car.
I know.
The cool thing about it is
it's unreal.
They have turned it into a running car now.
Yeah.
Yeah, see, I react to that car the same way I did the first time I ever saw a 63 split-window Stingray.
Oh, yeah.
It's that
stunning
kind of visceral. Well,
for me, Ed and his team have, we restored the original Stingray.
Oh, my God.
And we did it in-house in our shops. And,
my favorite all time.
You know, we all were just all over that thing, and it was so cool. But I think the aura of that car, and particularly some of the photography that was done with the car,
It lives in this.
Yeah, and you can just see it breathing out of it. And for me, that's the.
Does it have to be smaller though?
Well, if it's lighter, when I say smaller, I'm thinking 7/8 size, but it will be lighter.
But why do you have to shrink the car to get it lighter? I mean,
that's where I was going, but he cut me off and called me Sergeant. I don't know. I'm speechless. I don't know how to respond. But no, you're right on. I mean, that's the innovation that has to take place because
take 500 pounds.
Yeah,
out.
Because everybody says, well, GM, makes cars that are big that no one wants. Well, there's people that bought those cars, for some period of time, and I would say we didn't move small enough, fast enough in the United States. But you get out of the United States and you look at some of the stuff we do all over the world, and we can do this. We got to decide to do it, and we are. So we're going to do that. But the innovation, we can't just copy the small car market that's going to be in the United States here in 2 years. We got to take that and say, here's the mass efficiency that we need to have that leapfrogs just a smaller car, to your point. Okay, and that car needs to have that technology in it. And I'm not sure a smaller Corvette is the answer.
You're talking about lightweight materials? You're talking about, better design and getting it?
Well, it's all that. Okay, but I would say here's another thing to think about. Okay, there's the material. Everybody can think about and see and touch and feel carbon fiber, aluminum, all those things. Okay, but the magical piece that the auto industry hasn't completely revealed yet is the joint efficiency of the core structure of the car. Okay, and the reason why I say that is we have typically, as an industry, developed a structure, and then we have done things like aluminum motor compartments, or we've done a completely aluminum car. But if you look at the joint structure itself and the topology that's involved with the design analysis and the design for Six Sigma of what those joints have to be designed to actually do, we've only begun to scratch the surface of the job that each joint has to do.
They're way over-designed today? Is that what you're saying, or what?
I'm not sure they're way over-designed. I would say that we have not optimized the thickness of the metal in those joints or the material capabilities of the material in those joints. But to just say they're over-designed implies to everybody that they're big and they're heavy and all that. No, no, they're not, okay? But there's another squeeze of the material itself, the interface of the material in the joint, and the actual section that leads into that joint. You can tell I'm a body guy, but...
Are you guys poring over the specs on this new Lexus LFA? Have you seen the carbon fiber structure?
Yes.
The...
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, why not? Is GM going to buy one?
Yeah, we will. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, we can't stop doing that.
Even though the ZR1 still laps the Nürburgring faster than...
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's why I say there's... we can do very special things on lots of different kinds of cars, and we are beginning to look and see how to do that on all of our cars.
Well, let's say, it seems to me most cars today seem to fall in passenger cars I'm talking about now, 3,500 to 4,000 pounds.
Yep, yep.
What could you get down to?
Oh, we can get down, you can call it a test weight class, and a test weight class can either be 125 or 250. Okay, depending on where you are in that span, but 125 pounds on a mass efficiency basis is not that hard. Another 20
without increasing cost.
Yeah, yeah, you're going to see it.
What about using carbon fiber, more in bodies? I talked to the guys at Aptera recently, and they're using carbon fiber in the, it's a three-wheeled car.
Paul Wilbur's supposed to be on the show,
Yeah.
Yeah,
well,
we're working on getting him.
And he was talking about carbon fiber and how light it is, and that's why, they claim they're going to have the most efficient car in the world. Now, you're not going to do that, but you could use that for the Corvette because you get pricing on it.
Well, we do. And in fact, that's why I love the Grand Sport. And I tell you, I drove that for a week. And what it is, it's all the light, hair-raising quickness of a Z06 without, the big expensive, dry sump motor. But, it's an LS3 that is wonderful. And it for me, at that price point, which is a heck of a lot different than a Z06 or a ZR1, for me, that Grand Sport and the looks of it, too, is pretty,
especially the Roadster.
Yeah, and that has all the carbon fiber stuff on it, to your point. So it's got the body panels, it's got the aero tricks, it's got the, all the good stuff.
Flared fenders.
But that's an expensive way to do it.
Well, it is. That's my point. That's a really expensive way to do it because now it's less expensive than it was because they were traditionally done off of a Formula One style enclave.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then you get into the cycle time of carbon fiber. There's a cost of carbon fiber. Then there's a cycle time to actually make the part, which is high cost.
Is it strictly for low volume cars, Mark?
Pardon me?
Is carbon fiber strictly for low volume cars?
It was.
But isn't another thing is that what the industry's pretty much done heretofore is said, okay, here's this body in white that we have in steel. Now let's try to do it out of carbon fiber. And that's not the way to do it.
No,
I mean, you want to like filament wound,
Yeah, it's got to be an integral part of
They should look like missile tubes, essentially, right?
And that's the interesting thing on that Lexus LFA is...
It's integral.
Yeah.
A hang-on pad.
You've looked at it. Have you seen...
No, I have not.
They've revealed how they've done the basic structure, and it's a combination of carbon and aluminum. And
that's when I say the joint piece of this is the next frontier, John. Yeah.
Well, this gives us a great segue, actually, because we've got a new advertiser for Autoline Daily, our daily newscast, which is Dow Automotive Systems. And, we'd love to talk about what other sponsors of this show might be able to get if they were to come in and sponsor us. Although, as Peter and I have said, they might be a slightly mad to come in and sponsor a discussion like this.
Actually, as I tried to sell ads for Auto Extremis for 10 years and realized that, the most forward-thinking company would advertise in Auto Extremis because they aren't afraid of the high-octane truth. I think I had two advertisers. I had Kevin Beard of Pelote Shoes, because he's a buddy. And I had pickuptruck.com for 5 minutes, and then GM said, you cease and desist advertising on Auto Extremist, or we're going to pull your ads from your site.
Youch.
That was in 2001.
Didn't Chrysler advertise with you briefly?
Briefly.
Well, anyway, Dow Automotive Systems... is really pushing structural adhesives And that would seem to be tying in exactly what you're talking about now, right? Of
what
being
is?
Able to get lightweight structures. I mean, they're talking about it in terms of like the Jaguar XF and the Opel Insignia for improving crash and getting lighter weight for better fuel economy.
What is? And if you look at, and I hate to go back in time, but if you look at the EV1, okay?
Cool car. Yeah. I love that car. I'm telling you, man. I drove it.
One of the coolest things of that car was the backbone structure and the manufacturing of that. And the structural adhesive and riveting that went into the aluminum pieces of that on the joint structure of that was pioneering. And, you know, folks like Dow really helped us do that. And so I think, like you say, there's a structural piece of that, which is structural adhesive on the joining piece of it, which can create really innovative manufacturing techniques. But then there's the integration piece of this, okay? To fill a cavity that you couldn't fill regularly, to stop, you know, the sound path through the structure. These things, people don't give enough credit to some of these things that are really advanced adhesive and materials that help us integrate the car and create a cost-effective advantage for the customer on how the car actually operates. So it's a big part of the industry, and it's going to be even bigger.
It's a big part, too, because, you know, when you've got to spot weld things together, these days everything's robotized. So have to use huge areas for the robots to be able to get in, whereas if you can just glue it together, it's not as big a deal.
That's right. You cannot swallow some of the sections to get to a weld flange, and then you either MIG weld it or you get in there with an adhesive that really works.
Right.
So we're very happy Dow's on board.
We're happy, but we want them sponsoring this show, too, not just Autoline Daily. But
exactly. Go
click on their logo on our Autoline Daily site, and that'll convince them to come in and do this show, too.
The only thing I was going to say about the Grand Sport,
yep.
They show the car with these side stripes.
Yeah, the one I had didn't have it on it.
Yeah, and that's better because, you know, the fact of the matter is those side stripes were first used by the Shelby American Cobra team.
I know that.
At Sebring.
Yes.
They were never part of a Grand Sport at any time in history, and they need to pull those things off.
Listen to the man. He knows of which he speaks.
And Barry, you know, that shouldn't be offered on the car. It looks fine without him.
Yeah, it does.
You know, if anything... You know, if they want to do a white nose with the white stripe.
Did that before.
Yeah, just lose those side stripes.
But, I mean, the car is beautiful enough with the chrome piece on the louver and then the Z06 tire and wheel and brake, and, you know, it's all good.
So. Yeah, give me a black Roadster Grand Sport, I'd be happy. It's a cool car.
Well, let's get to the rapid-fire part of the show. Ben, let's bring up the graphic and let's bring out the questions.
I saw him on a show.
Done up like Rambo.
I watched one of them. Yeah, I don't know. I've never met him, but seemed like a good guy.
He's going to come back on for a guest shot here.
Okay, let's see. Here's a Roger Will wrote in to say, questions for Mr. Royce. Please give us your thoughts on Stephen Ratner's comments about poor management at GM.
Okay, well, you know, I read that just like everybody else, and, you know, it's hard for me to read it. It actually... you know, you spend your whole career in a company and making product and doing cars. And, you know, honestly, you wear it. I wear it. I wear every one of those, you know, and I don't wear it well, and it hurts. And so, you know, I always haven't been in management. I joined the company in 86, but, you know, I think it was a sweeping comment around all management. And so I have been in management, you know, in the last few years, although I've been in a couple different places. But I take that very personally. I'm accountable for that. And, you know, it's hard to take. And all I know is when I get up every morning and I start it, at 6 a.m. and we get in there and go at it, this is the time to change it. And I want to focus so hard and give everything that I have to change that. That's really all I care about. And so, you know, I don't want to judge him. He's someone that came in and looked at our company, and I take that very seriously. That's all I can say, you know, and I work every day to change that.
Good answer. Okay, Artemis 77 says, last time on Autoline After Hours, you guys said that all automobile advertising today is crap. I think they refer to you here, Peter. But what do you guys think of the new Lincoln commercials using covers of songs like Space Odyssey, Major Tom, I'm Burning for You, and real cool sci-fi visual effects, and the Cadillac Reignition commercial? I think these are some of the best car ads I've ever seen.
I think the Lincoln stuff is better than the Cadillac stuff. I think the Lincoln stuff's very well, very good.
I think I'm Burning for You is the best tune Boyz II Cold ever did.
Dude.
Not Fear the Reaper.
No. Burning for You is a better tune.
Okay, Scotty in Cleveland wants to know.
Scotty.
Whatever became of the new Nissan Forum concept from last year's Detroit Auto Show?
That crossover?
I can't picture it.
Yeah,
right,
it's
now.
That white crossover with the fabulous brown interior.
Right.
The interior was absolutely beautiful.
The interior was it, and with total flat floor to it, wasn't it as well?
I don't know what they're doing with that.
That's a good question. That's a really good question.
Very cool, though.
Okay. Dave Poole says, so Fritz Henderson says there's a new culture at GM. I won't believe it until Peter DeLorenzo says there is.
That's a big responsibility.
Well, I could be running General Motors someday, John. We all know this is a possibility.
Well, I think you all own it.
Yeah. Okay, question for Mr. Royce from Pedro Fernandez. Seems to me and a lot of other car guys I know that GM and some other OEM seem to be out of touch with what car buyers are looking for. Lower price, lighter, simpler vehicles. The trend continues with just the opposite. Higher prices and more complex vehicles. Your thoughts?
Well, it seems like it's a North American question, so I'll treat it that way. I think the gentleman is referring to North America again. So, there's a lot of, I think there, the energy that we have in the planet is limited, and so that's real. And so we have to start today to do things that doesn't destroy that finite energy supply. And so in the immediate term, it's easier to make a smaller car and help yourself that may be more, less cost because it's smaller and it's simpler and it's more fuel efficient. But at the end of the day, I still have three kids. And so if we can do that at a low cost with better fuel economy, with an attractive vehicle that is fun to drive, because I still don't think people want to drive the strangest, weirdest, cheapest thing out there. I think if we deliver that, I think that's where it's headed. And I think that's the reinvention of the auto industry. And so I still don't think that people want, just that. There may be people that use it as a utility. There's people out there
that
do that.
I think that was he wants simpler, smaller cars. That's fine.
Yeah.
But that's not what people. That's not what
it's a broad spectrum of buyers here.
It is. We have to do all that.
Absolutely. And for people to say, "Oh, we're all going to drive shiny, happy, smiley cars," it's just not going to work.
Look, whole thing about small cars. No. I mean, what's the Cobalt? The Cobalt's going to be rated close to 40, but you can get. Can't you get in a Malibu that's going to be over 30?
Yeah.
It's already over 30.
Equinox is over 30.
You can get a Bass Hybrid in that, too.
If you can get a Malibu over 30, by the way, that Cobalt's going to be 40 on the highway. So if the difference between a Cobalt and a Malibu is 4 or 5 mpg, no one's going to take the smaller car once a car is over 30, they're going to say, okay, give me the coolest or the biggest or the one that I want. They don't want smaller, they want efficient.
Yeah, no, I agree. And by the way, I don't want to drive the hairiest thing for the planet either. I don't like doing that. It feels bad. You go to the gas pump, you pay whatever the price is, and by the way, that will change. That's the only thing I know is it's going to change. And so in North America, and so I think no one likes to feel that way, and I don't want to be in an industry that's looked at like that.
I guess I better pull the plug on that mid-engine SRX with the Can-Am motor in the back seat that I've been working on in my garage. Damn.
It's still a worthwhile concept.
Okay.
Okay, we got a couple of questions that were phoned in. Ben, why don't you start with John Farrell, who's got a question about natural gas.
Hey, this is John Farrell calling from Westchester, Pennsylvania. Got a question for Mark Royce. Since you've done a lot of the research and development and safety testing for putting a hydrogen fuel cell in an Equinox. Could you use the work that you've done and the testing that you've done and apply that to putting a compressed natural gas cylinder in an Equinox?
That's a great question, and I hope I didn't cut you off. Did you have anything more or no?
No, you got it. All right.
That's a great question because, you know, one of the great natural resources that we have is these gas reserves, right? And the compressed piece of this, we actually are doing this on a lot of Opel product in Germany, and we do it in the Zafira in particular because the Zafira platform is a good platform on a fleet basis to get some volume out there and get that data. And so we have it. It's not talked about in the United States too much, but that's been going on for about 3 years now. And we're actually doing conversions of cars for people that want to do this in Europe, in Millbrook, in the UK, which is one of our proving ground facilities there. So we've actually got an upfitter there that's doing a little bit of LPG and CNG. And, you know, the obviously the infrastructure here is a little bit problematic because you got to have places where you can get it and put it in the tank. But, yes, absolutely. We that is something that is very, very much looked at. And in Thailand, we're running them. We're running them in fleets and in cars you'd recognize here under different brands. So they're out there. Yeah, we're doing it.
Good. And Ben, we got another question from Todd here. The note that you gave me says let's bring Todd in.
Yes, Mr. Russ. My name is Todd. I'm calling from Charlotte, North Carolina, and I'd like to know, will current small block V8 engines at least maintain their cubic inches of displacement for the future? Thank you very much. Bye.
All right. Thank you. That's a great question. You know, our small block lineup is pretty broad. And so as long as people want those engines either in, you know, cylinder deactivation or AFM or, you know, or E85 form, or, you know, we've got lots of alternative fuels and technologies that are put into those engines to make them more fuel efficient, because we do know that people still like to tow things, particularly here in the United States with V8s and Australia. I mean, V8s are still a big percentage of volume there, so the Middle East as well. So, yeah, I mean, the answer to that is, yeah, I mean, we're not going to just throw out the small block V8. That would, I think that would aggravate a lot of customers. So, we're going to make, if the customers are telling us that that's what they want to buy, then we're going to make them.
You know, I've always said that when we really do get that UFO in Roswell and start to take it apart to reverse engineer it, there's going to be a small block V8 in the heart of that thing, I'm telling you.
I love that, John.
Yeah, that's
and
I love that.
I keep good. Saying it might run on dilithium crystals, but it's going to be a small block V8.
Yeah, that's it.
We got another question here from Phil. Ben, why don't, let's bring that one in, too.
Hello, John. I still have a question about the Pontiac Vibe lost from the Pontiac line. Is there any chance of it ever reappearing in GM's lineup?
No.
You know, talking about cars that are light in weight, I just happened to get an 05 GT, and that thing is everything I like in a car. It's got a lot of size, it's got low weight, and it really goes, gets terrific mileage. It's got a high output engine. I know the emissions pretty well cancel out that particular engine. It was the Celica engine, high output Celica engine, 1.8. But is there any chance of any of that coming back into the GM lineup? The Vibe is a very, very reliable vehicle. Did it just get lost entirely when GM separated from Toyota?
I mean, yeah. the actual Vibe did. You know, you're absolutely right. And so the architecture it was built off of and what it was as a joint venture with Toyota is gone. I think that's been talked about.
But you've got new stuff coming.
I was going to say, that type of car, you'll see again. So it'll just be a little different than what you saw, and hopefully it'll be better for you.
The Vibe GT was pretty fun to drive.
It was very fun.
I like that car quite
a bit. The second generation Vibe, I loved the style.
Yeah. Second generation,
especially the rear three-quarter view. That is a good-looking car.
There was some out there.
Yeah.
The view from the rear was good, and the Vibe GT was a hell of a lot of fun to drive.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, Espo wrote in to say, Mark, will direct injection make its way into the small block V8s for trucks?
Well, I think, you know, this is our first, introduction was into V6 for lots of good reasons, because it's our most global engine. And so that's where we really brought it in, and we brought it in hard and in high volume, and we got the big bang that we thought we would with customers. So I think, you know, that technology is only in its infancy, to answer that question. Yeah.
Okay, Jim Haynes wrote in to say, what will it take to reinvigorate Buick? They do have a great CUV and two cars, one great, brand new, and one not too old, but with only three products. How do you get the buzz going again?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, Jack Keebler works in our company, and I had this discussion with him on this Volt ride. And I said, you know, we had a hard time, I think, describing what Buick was or wanted to be there for a few years and, you know, several years or whatever you want
to. I still can't get anyone in the company to tell me what the brand image is. So
all right, well,
please do.
Well, no, I think all you got to do is drive an Enclave. Okay, and I won't give some kind of fancy description.
Enclave's great vehicle.
Yeah, and the Enclave is Buick, and so you say, well, what's an Enclave? Okay, and we'll take that to the next step. It's now a direct injected 3.6, which is an awesome powertrain for that platform. It is one of the quietest SUV crossovers out there, if not the quietest. It is all about refinement. But I don't think I'm going to take a Buick to a track and run a runoff against a bunch of imported automakers that have very fast, high-performance cars. We're not going to do that. Cadillac is doing that because we're extending the brand of Cadillac to be able to be high-performance. It's edgy. It's all that. I'm not going to use all the clever marketing words for that. But all you got to look at the Enclave and then look at the LaCrosse. And the LaCrosse and the Enclave, finally, I think, is what Buick is in GM. And I started at Buick. So, I've seen it all. Worked in Buick City, did all that, you know. So I think I know what it should be now and in the future, and those two cars are it.
I'm paraphrasing a couple of questions here, but several viewers point out Ford got great kudos this week from Consumer Reports.
Yep.
GM on a few models, but what's it going to take to at least match what Ford did and then catch up with Toyota and Honda?
Yeah, I don't really want to match what Ford did. I'd like to be the best, okay? So, I gave a little talk to our employees here a week ago. And somewhere along the line, when someone asks you again, has GM's culture changed, you won't have all the little things that are fun to talk about, but you'll say, well, you know, we're going to eliminate the words competitive, okay, and replace it with winning.
Good.
Okay. And these are words, and you guys are the masters of words. I'm not. But I think these are pretty important things. And someone says, we got a balanced car. When someone says we got a balanced car, I feel funny because it means mediocre. Okay, so if we're going to do competitive balanced cars, we aren't going to win. So if we can, if you look at that data in Consumer Reports, the GM cars hit the ball out of the park on performance and safety, and our reliability is unknown on our new models. And so that's where we're in the funny business, right? Because no one's really trusting us right now, and I don't blame them. And so what I told our team is that we got to fix the reliabilities of these cars. I had dinner with a friend of mine who doesn't buy GM, and I was giving the business on that in a friendly way. I said, you buy whatever you want, but tell me why you're buying it. And he says, you know what, Mark? He said, I don't want something that breaks. And I said, you know, that hurts. But we earned that reputation over quite a long period of time. We didn't do it last year. We didn't do it the year before, but we did it over a long time. And so we have got to fix that now. We've got the performance, and we've got the safety, and we've got great cars, but I can't market reliability because we haven't been out there with our new products for 10 years to earn it. And so we got to earn it. We've got to do it for a long time. We've got to do it in every product. There's no magic silver bullet on that. That's what we got to do.
Good. Andrew Charles wrote in to say, we keep hearing that GM is dropping rear-wheel drive models like the G8 and the STS because of CAFE and fuel economy. Can you explain the logic behind this when, in practice, GM's rear drive or all-wheel drive cars get better economy than their front drive all-wheel drive cars?
Well, those are that is a generalization, and I think we could go into each model and say, well, you know, there's no way that a G8 gets better fuel economy than our Malibu. Okay, so those are almost the same package size. And so you say, okay, well, the size of the car, and then you say, well, they got different powertrains, yes. But if you took a V6 and to a V6 on that, and you say, okay, one is better than the other, yeah, they are, and that's not the only reason, okay? There's not a huge market, even though the wild popularity of a G8 that was here very briefly, the size of that market until we incentivized that car wasn't there, and that was when gas was right around $4, if you remember right. So all you got to do is have a gas spike here, and everybody puts their wallet in their pocket, right, and starts buying differently. And so we got to be careful of that. It doesn't mean we go one way or the other. We've typically swung the pendulum so hard sometimes in GM that we then neglect the other piece of it because we're trying to race to where the market is, and then when we get there, it's been too late. So we got to anticipate where we're going to go. Gas prices are going to be in the $4 to $5 range, like the rest of the world here in this country. And so we can't ignore that. So we got to have both of those products in here. We're not going to abandon all of it, like you say. We got to have all that. So I don't think it's that clean.
Okay, and this will probably be the last question for Rapid Fire, but this comes in from Jay Cujo. Why are the colors of GM mid-sized cars so bland? No cool colors like blues, greens, a bright red.
Oh, wow. That's a question for Chris Webb, who runs our color studios. But, I come from a country here in the last 2 years that had probably the best color palette I've ever seen.
Australia?
Yeah.
Why?
And because that progression of colors was done. We had four new colors every 6 months in that plant. Okay, Atomic Green. You're gonna see a
color. I like the name.
Yeah, Atomic Green. It's awesome. It just says, why is that?
No. What kind of green are we talking about?
Okay, you're gonna see a car at SEMA here that's a Camaro, that's Atomic Green, and it's I don't see anything here that's Atomic Green, but
is it a bright green or?
It's a bright green metallic. It's not a forest green. It's a bright green metallic. Okay, we've also got another color in that palette that's called Wildfire. And you're going to see Wildfire here, too. So we're validating.
Wait, so you guys are going to be selling an Atomic Green Camaro?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
There. David got some news out of this.
No. Hey. You go to SEMA and weigh in on it, and then I'll bet you someone's going to want to do that. But it's dynamite. Ed Wilbur and I stood in our shops downstairs there, and he said, look at this. And I said, this is unreal. So we got some cool.
But that's Camaro, and this guy's asking mid-size cars. You know, I think he's got a good point.
Yeah,
colors
no,
can
he does.
Dramatically change the look of a car.
I totally agree. And you know, we probably too conservative. That's
there
the only thing I can say. And so you know, but Chris Webb, if you meet Chris Webb out of our design studios, he is not conservative. He's not. But I think that's a great point.
Yeah.
I really do. Yeah.
Good. Well, look, it's the top of the hour. We ought to wrap up the official part of the show here. But, Mark, it's been great having you here.
Oh, I really appreciate
it. We could go on another three or four hours,
sure.
I think, easily.
Oh, it's a great question. I'm so impressed with the audience and the questions here. This was, wow. Yeah, very cool.
Good.
Yeah.
David Welch, great having you here.
Always good to be here.
Renzo, extremist, uber alles. Yeah, great having you here, too. And, want to thank Alan Adler and GM Communications for helping us make the show possible and getting it on the GM website.
Thank you, Alan.
here's a question I didn't get in earlier, but why are we waiting so long for a new Impala? I mean, you guys did pretty good volume non-fleet, you know, some time ago, and now it's mostly a fleet car, and that, you know, you guys, I mean, it looks like you're sort of pulling a Taurus on this, and not the new one, but you know, the old one, when they just let the thing go too long. I mean, the current Impala is old enough to shave. When are we going to see?
Well, we went through bankruptcy.
Right.
So there's the portfolio churn that we had was I've never, ever seen that, you know. And so when you lose the brands and, you know, you don't have the money to spend and you're scratching for every single thing that you can do, there's some tough calls made on timing. And so would we like to have something, you know, tomorrow? Yeah, that'd be great. But, you know.
Isn't it the best selling car that GM has in North America, though?
I'd have to look at that. I don't know off the top of my head.
I looked, the Impala was still outselling the Malibu.
Yeah, I think it
Shocker,
is.
Shocker, and outselling.
Yeah,
that's a lot of fleet Impala.
I know. Yeah, but, yeah. But boy, you guys have got so much potential.
That's what I mean.
With doing an Impala right. Nail that thing.
There's a huge opportunity cost here.
I was going to say, you focused on the timing thing, okay? I think the other part of the company that's quite different is, you know, we used to march to the drum of how fast is our product development cycle and then we're going to have a conversation with the Wall Street Journal, and then the Wall Street Journal is going to pair us off against our competition. I mean, everybody in the industry is pretty close to being the same. And so what we don't want to do is make the wrong calls in the space of the time for a car like that and miss something. And so we've done that in the past, too. And I don't care if it's styling or performance or quality, we're not going to do that anymore. We're going to pick a competitor, we're going to go after it, and we're going to anticipate where they're going to be, and then we're going to beat it. And there's going to be five reasons on that car why someone is going to not walk into another person's showroom, is going to come into ours. And if I can't articulate, and our team can't articulate those five reasons why someone's going to walk into a GM showroom and give us another chance to buy that car, then we shouldn't be doing the car.
Well, it helps, right? Getting rid of four brands is going to make that a whole lot easier.
Are you going to move it up then?
Absolutely.
Are we going to see something sooner than we thought? Or sooner than...
On the Impala or something? Or,
yeah.
I don't think, I don't know what you're thinking it's going to be, but...
I'm here in 2012 or 13.
Yeah, I don't want to get into a timing discussion on it, but because I can't, because I don't think those decisions are quite done.
Okay.
And so, really, in the new company, you have to look at every one of these things you put into any market and say, who are you going to beat, what's the mission of the car, and what are the five things that you're going to do to take someone away to give us a chance again, because this isn't like everybody's waiting for GM to emerge and then we're going to give you a second chance. We got to prove on a car by car basis why someone's going to come in there and buy it. That is the core of who we're going to be and who we are. That's very different from filling a plant on a manufacturing strategy or filling a fleet market or either we win or we don't do it.
Another question is, if you guys want to do a Chevy version of the G8 for this market, why do you have to make it in Australia? Why can't you make it in Canada where you make the Camaro? I mean, it's basically, isn't the Camaro a modified version of the same platform?
Heavily modified. Think about the front proportion of that car, okay, to get a pony car look out of it. And, we took Zeta and did all kinds of things to the front motor compartment of that car. And that's not the only car they make.
Right,
it's got to be same bill of process?
It is a very similar bill of process.
Okay. So
the plant's flexible.
So the plant's flexible. Mm-hmm.
So and the plant literally can do it.
Oh, absolutely.
So giddy up. I mean, why not?
Every time you tool something in a different country with a different supply base, you got to go do a new car.
Oh,
because,
really?
Well... Let's think about this. You take the parts, okay, and they just put them into the North American supply base from the Asia Pacific supply base, and not validate what you just did.
Is the cadre of suppliers for the Australian cars that different in terms of the companies? Then
his first comments in this show was how vertically integrated Holden was. You walk into that plant, and we're making fascias, we're making all the body parts, right?
Wow. Castings. You do all your own castings.
The market there is 1 million units. It's got 65 brands, okay, and only 3 produce there. So the supply base is fragile, very fragile.
Interesting.
So think about that.
Wow.
See, everybody's got to remember, too, is Australia is essentially landmass-wise the size of the lower 48 states with the population of Michigan and Ohio.
20 million. 20 million.
Michigan and Ohio, that's the population of the country.
Well, it's all along the coast and the big cities.
Right. So, but the 20 million is the key. It's
the 20 million.
They're the masters, the people in Australia, and Australian auto industry at very low production volume. I mean, they've got to be able to make all their ROI, all their investment on volumes that are a fraction of what everybody else is used to dealing
with. It's a million unit market.
So you would have to get all these... You'd have to get all these North American suppliers who aren't doing business down there to tool up.
It's massive.
Wow.
And our supply base is fragile. Here.
Wow.
So and there. So that's a big bet. And forget about the plant. The plant can make it. Not an issue.
Interesting.
You got to think about the business of bringing the car there, which is quite different.
I got a few other things I got to get through here, too. For those who are still watching, you can friend us on Facebook. We're facebook.com/AutoLineDetroit. You can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/AutoLine. You can follow Peter at twitter.com/AutoExtremist. And you can look for David's stuff at, AutoBeatBlog.com. at businessweek.com.
No, just businessweek.com and then look for the Auto Beat blog.
Gotcha. Okay. What he said.
And I do, I am on Twitter at least once a month. I go and tweet.
Yeah.
Whether I need to or not.
That's my line about brushing my teeth. And you can subscribe to us at the iTunes store, too.
There we go.
Yeah. Oh, Alfa Romeo come to the U.S. What do you make of that, Mark? Another competitor.
I like those.
They're beautiful.
We all like Alphas, but I think their vision of what they think they can do with Alfa in a short period of time is crazy.
No, they're not going to get the volume, but I'd like a Mito.
Yeah, the Mito could be cool.
Well, you know, I looked at I was fired up.
The Barrera.
I was fired up about the Mito until I crawled around it at Paris, and it was just like, it's kind of cool, but it's not that cool. Now, an 8C Competizione, that's a whole other thing.
Well, that's a whole other price point,
too. I think every car in their line is gorgeous. I'd give any one of them a look.
And, you know, we never got into the news today. We like to do that a lot, too. But what do you think of Fisker getting the Wilmington plant?
Well, I think I read their press release on it, you know, and I'm happy for the people there because I'm one of the guys that bought a Solstice before we knew that Pontiac wasn't going to be around. So I still like the car and the value of the car, and it's a fun car. And so they got the tooling for that and the plant, you know. And so there's a lot of things.
Are they going to get that car? They're going to get that tooling?
Well, when I say the tooling, the manufacturing system.
Okay, the manufacturing equipment.
Yeah.
Right.
And so I would assume they're getting a lot of that. And so... you know,
for nothing. It's like $18 million. What was the price? Wasn't it like $18 million or something for the place?
Yeah. Well, I think that's great. Yeah. I mean, anything for me that helps the United States manufacturing basis here is a good thing for everybody. Yeah.
I hope it works.
Yeah,
that's
I do, too.
I do, too. But if Fisker doesn't make it, does the Perpetual Motion Machine Company take the plant over after that with government funding? Sorry, that was very cynical.
The magnetic motor. I know, but... We've talked about this before. We're all pretty cynical about these upstarts and, you know, who are getting big amounts of money from the government.
I'd like to see them work. I just, I'm really skeptical that they can do it.
I'd like to see them work, too. I would just like Henrik to dial back on his pronouncements about 90% because we're in the show-me stage now.
Right.
They're talking about 130,000 units of plug-in hybrid global volume.
But a mainstream, this car is going to be a mainstream midsize car. I mean, let's get the Karma over here and let's sell that.
Yeah.
Let's service it.
Yep, see what happens.
It is a good-looking car.
Yeah. Let's create the customer experience. Let's see how all that goes.
And then talk about the
next then
stuff.
Let's talk about...
Well, every time I talk to these, I shouldn't say every time, but with a lot of these guys I talk to, when they talk about the profitability of their company, you got to, cover one eye and close one ear, close one eye and cover one ear to get to their profit projections. And then, they all talk about their pricing and they say, well, it's a $40,000 car, after the $7,500 federal rebate. But it doesn't work that way. If your car is $48,000, you don't go to the dealership and pay $40,000 because there's a $7,500 tax credit. You pay the $48,000. Then you apply for the tax credit, and then you get it back in your tax return. So if you buy that green vehicle in January, you ain't going to see that money again until May of the following year when you get your tax return. So you got to go and still finance all of this. I mean, it's not...
That's a good point. That's a really good point.
And it's not... If it was a $2,000... federal tax credit, that's one thing. Most people can ride that for a year. But you're talking about $7,500 that someone has to put up front and finance and then come back around and collect it later. So when they tell me, they always do this, Tesla and Fisker both played the same game. Yeah, the Model S is going to be $50,000 after the $7,500 federal rebate. But that's not how the whole thing works.
Yeah, I guess. Well, good. Thanks,
Mark.
Really great having you here.
Great
discussion.
And it's been a while.
We never talked about Lutz's results today.
Oh, yeah, that's right. We never got to – that was the CTS challenge.
Heinrichsi did the quick lap by almost 3 seconds.
Yeah, Aaron Link did it by 2 seconds. I sent Aaron Link out there.
Who's Aaron Link? I don't know him.
He's one of our youngest, brightest engineers that that I can think of, and he's just a great guy.
And is the Brian Redman that was on the list, is that the Brian Redman?
That's
okay.
Brian Redman.
So yeah, it was pretty good. And I read the blog results of it too, which I guess were a little profane in some ways, but you know, I'm happy. I worked hard on that car with a lot of really good engineers and the engineers that were there driving it.
It's a superb car.
Yeah,
it is.
I mean, we got him out on MRC at the Proving Grounds on last Friday to do a little practice with the car so that we could, you know, make sure he knew where the limits were, and that's all we did. And he clicked off, you know, 211 on MRC, which is really good. So we were all very, very, you know, pretty happy with that, and felt good about him going out there with that car. That car is a phenomenal car.
It's a fabulous car.
And a lot of the car. Well, what about that? You know, the thing we're proud about is the car thermally can do lots of laps before anything shows a sign of weakness on a thermal from a thermal standpoint. The differentials, the steering gears, the knuckles, the brakes, the whole deal. So, and our transmission, you know, he ran an automatic out there. I don't know if you caught that or not, but he ran a really good automatic out there, which we're pretty proud of that too. So,
now something online said that some mystery driver got out there and beat Heinrichsi's time. Did any of you catch that? I didn't see that.
I didn't catch it. I was working. I checked in, and you know,
it was Tony Stewart.
Was it?
No, I'm kidding.
I don't know.
Well, look, take somebody very special to beat Heinrichsi in a CTS, a car that he knows really, really well.
Yep.
Take somebody awfully damn good to beat him.
Yep, that's right. Our level three drivers inside the company have to get within, you know, fractions of Heinrichsi's time to be level three. Aaron Link's one of them. And so we got about, I would say, 15 young guns in the company that can really drive cars and develop them really well.
Where's Bob on that scale?
So, you know, we haven't had him in a place where we can evaluate that.
He said diplomatically.
No. You run 211. Our guns are running, you know, a couple seconds off that, which is, you know, that's pretty good.
It's
damn
good.
We're all thrilled.
That's competitive.
Yeah, no, it's good. No, it's remember that word's not good.
Oh, yeah.
No.
Got to be winning.
Yeah, he's winning for his age and horsepower in that car.
Not going to say it.
Yeah. No. That's a good push.
Not going to think it.
Yeah.
Good.
Visit our website, OuterLineDetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern, get your daily automotive news fix with Outerline Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with Outerline Detroit. That's all there, and much more, at OuterLineDetroit.tv.